strong and proud he is. Where is his harness? It should be rich and fair.
None is rich and fair enough for him, said Pippin. He will have none. If he will consent to bear you he does, and if not, well, no bit, bridle, whip, or thong will tame him. Farewell, Shadowfax. Have patience. Battle is coming.
Shadowfax lifted up his head and neighed, so that the stable shook, and they covered their ears. Then they took their leave, seeing that the manger was well filled.
And now for our manger, said Beregond, and he led Pippin back to the citadel, and so to a door in the north side of the great tower. There they went down a long, cool stair into a wide alley lit with lamps. There were hatches in the walls at the side, and one of these was open.
"This is the storehouse and buttery of my company of the guard," said Beregond. "Greetings, Targon," he called through the hatch. "It's early yet, but here is a new cupboard that the Lord has taken into his service. He's ridden long and far, with a tight belt, and has had sore labour this morning, and he's hungry. Give us what you have."
They got their bread and butter and cheese and apples, the last of the winter store, wrinkled but sound and sweet, and a leather flagon of new-drawn ale, and wooden platters and cups. They put all into a wicker basket and climbed back into the sun. And Beregond brought Pippin to a place at the east end of the great outthrust battlement, where there was an embrasure in the walls with a stone seat beneath the sill. From there they could look out on the morning over the world. They ate and drank, and they talked now of Gondor and its ways and customs, now of the Shire and the strange countries that Pippin had seen.
And ever as they talked, Beregond was more amazed, and looked with greater wonder at the hobbit, swinging his short legs as he sat on the seat, or standing tiptoe upon it to peer over the sill at the lands below.
"I will not hide from you, Master Peregrine," said Beregond, "that to us you look almost as one of our children, a lad of 9 summers or so, and yet you have endured perils and seen marvels that few of our greybeards could boast of. I thought it was the whim of our lord to take him a noble page, after the manner of the kings of old, they say. But I see that it is not so, and you must pardon my foolishness."
"I do," said Pippin, "though you're not far wrong. I'm still little more than a boy in the reckoning of my own people, and it will be 4 years yet before I come of age, as we say in the Shire. But don't bother about me. Come and look and tell me what I can see."
The sun was now climbing, and the mists in the valley below had been drawn up. The last of them were floating away just overhead, as wisps of white cloud borne on the stiffened breeze from the east that was now flapping and tugging the flags and white standards of the citadel. Away down in the valley bottom, 5 leagues or so as the eye leaps, the great river could now be seen grey and glittering, coming out of the northwest and bending in a mighty sweep south and west again, till it was lost to view in a haze and shimmer, far beyond which lay the sea 50 leagues away. Pippin could see all the Pelennor laid out before him, dotted into the distance with farmsteads and little walls, barns and byres, but nowhere could he see any kine or other beasts. Many roads and tracks crossed the green fields, and there was much coming and going, wains moving in lines towards the great gate, and others passing out. Now and again a horseman would ride up and leap from the saddle and hasten into the city. But most of the traffic went away along the chief highway, and that turned south, and then, bending swifter than the river, skirted the hills and passed soon from sight. It was wide and well paved, and along its eastern edge ran a broad green riding track, and beyond that a wall. On the ride horsemen galloped to and fro, but all the streets seemed to be choked with great covered wains going south. But soon Pippin saw that all was in fact well ordered. The wains were moving in 3 lines, one swifter, drawn by horses, another slower, great wagons with fair housings of many colours, drawn by oxen, and along the west rim of the road many smaller carts hauled by trudging men.
"That is the road to the vales of Tumladen and Lossarnach, and the mountain villages, and then on to Lebennin," said Veragond. "There go the last of the wains that bear away to refuge the aged, the children, and the women that must go with them. They must all be gone from the gate and the road clear for a league before noon. That was the order. It was a sad necessity," he sighed. "Few, maybe, of those now sundered will meet again, and there were always too few children in this city, but now there are none, save some young lads that will not depart, and may find some task to do. My own son is one of them." They fell silent for a while. Pippin gazed anxiously eastward, as if at any moment he might see thousands of orcs pouring over the fields.
"What can I see there?" he asked, pointing down to the middle of the great curve of the Anduin. "Is that another city, or what is it?"
"It was a city," said Beregond, "the chief city of Gondor, of which this was only a fortress. For that is the ruin of Osgiliath on either side of Anduin, which our enemies took and burned long ago. Yet we won it back in the days of the youth of Denethor, not to dwell in, but to hold as an outpost, and to rebuild the bridge for the passage of our arms. And then came the fell riders out of Minas Morgul."
"The black riders?" said Pippin, opening his eyes, and they were white and dark, with an old fear reawakened.
"Yes, they were black," said Beregond, "and I see that you know something of them, though you have not spoken of them in any of your tales."
"I know of them," said Pippin softly, "but I'll not speak of them now, so near, so near." He broke off and lifted his eyes above the river, and it seemed to him that all he could see was a vast and threatening shadow. Perhaps it was mountains looming on the verge of sight, their jagged edges softened by well-nigh 20 leagues of misty air. Perhaps it was but a cloud wall, and beyond that again a yet deeper gloom. But even as he looked, it seemed to his eyes that the gloom was growing and gathering very slowly, slowly rising to smother the regions of the sun.
"So near to Mordor," said Beregond quietly. "Yes, there it lies. We seldom name it, but we have dwelt ever in sight of that shadow. Sometimes it seems fainter and more distant, sometimes nearer and darker. It is growing and darkening now, and therefore our fear and disquiet grow too. And the fell riders, less than a year ago they won back the crossings, and many of our best men were slain. Boromir it was that drove the enemy at last back from this western shore, and we hold still the near half of Osgiliath, for a little while. But we await now a new onslaught there, maybe the chief onslaught of the war that comes."
"When?" said Pippin. "Have you a guess? For I saw the beacons last night and the errand riders, and Gandalf said that it was a sign that the war had begun. He seemed in a desperate hurry. But now everything seems to have slowed up again."
"Only because everything is now ready," said Beregond. "It is but the deep breath before the plunge."
"But why were the beacons lit last night?"
"It is over late to send for aid when you are already besieged," answered Beregond. "But I don't know the counsel of the Lord and his captains. They have many ways of gathering news. And the Lord Denethor is unlike other men. He sees far. Some say that as he sits alone in his high chamber in the tower at night, and bends his thought this way and that, he can read somewhat of the future, and that he will at times search even the mind of the enemy, wrestling with him. And so it is that he is old, worn before his time. But however that may be, my lord Faramir is abroad, beyond the river on some perilous errand, and he may have sent tidings. But if you would know what I think set the beacons ablaze, it was the news that came yester-eve out of Lebenin. There is a great fleet drawing near to the mouths of Anduin, manned by the corsairs of Umbar in the south. They've long ceased to fear the might of Gondor, and they've allied them with the enemy, and now make a heavy stroke in his cause. For this attack will draw off much of the help that we looked to have from Lebenin and Belfalas, where folk are hardy and numerous. All the more do our thoughts go north to Rohan, and the more glad are we for these tidings of victory that you bring. And yet—" he paused and stood up and looked round, north, east, and south. The doings at Isengard should warn us that we are caught now in a great net and strategy. This is no longer a bickering at the fords, raiding from Ithilien and from Anorion, ambushing and pillaging. This is a great war long planned, and we are but one piece in it, whatever pride may say. Things move in the far east, beyond the inland sea, it is reported, and north in Mirkwood and beyond, and south in Harad. And now all realms shall be put to the test, to stand or fall under the shadow. Yet, Master Peregrine, we have this honour. Ever we bear the brunt of the chief hatred of the Dark Lord, for that hatred comes down out of the depths of time and over the deeps of the sea. Here will the hammer stroke fall hardest, and for that reason Mithrande came hither in such haste. For if we fall, who shall stand? And, Master Peregrine, do you see any hope that we shall stand? Pippin didn't answer. He looked at the great walls, and the towers and brave banners, and the sun in the high sky, and then at the gathering gloom in the east, and he thought of the long fingers of that shadow, of the orcs in the woods and the mountains, the treason of Isengard, the birds of evil eye, and the black riders, even in the lanes of the Shire, and of the winged terror, the Nazgul. He shuddered, and hope seemed to wither. And even at that moment the sun for a second faltered and was obscured, as though a dark wing had passed across it. Almost beyond hearing he thought he caught, high and far up in the heavens, a cry, faint but heart-quelling, cruel and cold. He blanched and cowered against the wall. "What was that?" asked Beregond. "You also felt something?"
"Yes," muttered Pippin. "It's a sign of our fall, and the shadow of doom, a fell rider of the air."
"Yes, the shadow of doom," said Beregond. "I fear that Minas Tirith shall fall. Night comes. The very warmth of my blood seems stolen away."
For a time they sat together with bowed heads and did not speak. Then suddenly Pippin looked up and saw that the sun was still shining and the banner still streaming in the breeze. He shook himself. "It's past," he said. "Now my heart will not yet despair. Gandalf fell and has returned and is with us. We may stand, if only on one leg, or at least be left still upon our knees."
"Rightly said," cried Beregond, rising and striding to and fro. "Nay, though all things must come utterly to an end in time, Gondor shall not perish yet. Not though the walls be taken by a reckless foe that will build a hill of carrion before them. There are still other fastnesses, and secret ways of escape into the mountains. Hope and memory shall live still in some hidden valley where the grass is green.
All the same, I wish it was over for good or ill," said Pippin. "I'm no warrior at all, and dislike any thought of battle, but waiting on the edge of one that I can't escape is worst of all. What a long day it seems already. I should be happier if we were not obliged to stand and watch, making no move, striking nowhere first. No stroke would have been struck in Rohan, I think, but for Gandalf."
"Ah, there you lay your finger on the sore that many feel," said Beregond. "But things may change when Faramir returns. He's bold, more bold than many deem, for in these days men are slow to believe that a captain can be wise and learned in the scrolls of lore and song, as he is, and yet a man of hardihood and swift judgment in the field. But such is Faramir, less reckless and eager than Boromir, but not less resolute. Yet what indeed can he do? We cannot assault the mountains of yonder realm. Our reach is shortened, and we cannot strike till some foe comes within it. Then our hand must be heavy." He smote the hilt of his sword. Pippin looked at him, tall and proud and noble, as all the men that he had yet seen in that land, and with a glitter in his eye as he thought of the battle. "Alas, my own hand feels as light as a feather," he thought, but he said nothing. "A pawn, did Gandalf say? Perhaps, but on the wrong chessboard." So they talked until the sun reached its height, and suddenly the noon bells were rung, and there was a stir in the citadel, for all save the watchman were going to their meal. "Will you come with me?" said Beregond. "You may join my mess for this day. I don't know to what company you'll be assigned, or the Lord may hold you at his own command. But you'll be welcome, and it will be well to meet as many men as you may, while there's yet time."
"I shall be glad to come," said Pippin. "I'm lonely, to tell you the truth. I left my best friend behind in Rowan, and I've had no one to talk to or jest with. Perhaps I could really join your company? Are you the captain? If so, you could take me on, or speak for me?"
"Nay, nay," Beregond laughed. "I'm no captain, neither office nor rank nor lordship have I, being but a plain man-of-arms of the third company of the citadel. Yet, Master Peregrine, to be only a man-of-arms of the guard of the Tower of Gondor is held worthy in the city, and such men have honour in the land."
"Then it's far beyond me," said Pippin. "Take me back to our room, and if Gandalf is not there, I'll go where you like, as your guest."
Gandalf was not in the lodging, and had sent no message, so Pippin went with Beregond and was made known to the men of the third company. And it seemed that Beregond got as much honour from it as his guest, for Pippin was very welcome. There had already been much talk in the citadel about Mithrandir's companion and his long closeting with the Lord, and rumour declared that a prince of the halflings had come out of the north to offer allegiance to Gondor and 5,000 swords. And some said that when the riders came from Rohan, each would bring behind him a halfling warrior, small maybe, but doughty. Though Pippin had regretfully to destroy this hopeful tale, he could not be rid of his new rank, only fitting, men thought, to one befriended by Boromir and honoured by the Lord Denethor. And they thanked him for coming among them, and hung on his words and stories of the outlands, and gave him as much food and ale as he could wish. Indeed, his only trouble was to be wary, according to the counsel of Gandalf, and not to let his tongue wag freely after the manner of a hobbit among friends. At length Beregond rose. "Farewell for this time," he said. "I have duty now till sundown, as have all the others here, I think. But if you're lonely, as you say, maybe you would like a merry guide about the city. My son would go with you gladly. A good lad, I may say. If that pleases you, go down to the lowest circle, and ask for the old guest house in the Rath Caledine, the Lamprite Street. You'll find him there with other lads that are remaining in the city. There may be things worth seeing down at the great gate ere the closing."
He went out, and soon after all the others followed. The day was still fine, though it was growing hazy, and it was hot for March, even so far southwards. Pippin felt sleepy, but the lodging seemed cheerless, and he decided to go down and explore the city. He took a few morsels that he had saved to Shadowfax, and they were graciously accepted, though the horse seemed to have no lack. Then he walked on down many winding ways. People stared much as he passed. To his face men were gravely courteous, saluting him after the manner of Gondor with bowed heads and hands upon the breast. But behind him he heard many calls, as those out of doors cried to others within to come and see the Prince of the Halflings, the companion of Mithrandir. Many used some other tongue than the common speech, but it was not long before he learned at least what was meant by Ernili Ferianath, and knew that his title had gone down before him into the city. He came at last by arch streets, and many fair alleys and pavements to the lowest and widest circle, and there he was directed to the Lamprite Street, a broad way running towards the great gate. In it he found the old guest house, a large building of grey weathered stone, with two wings running back from the street, and between them a narrow greensward, behind which was the many-windowed house, fronted along its whole width by a pillared porch and a flight of steps down onto the grass. Boys were playing among the pillars, the only children that Pippin had seen in Minas Tirith, and he stopped to look at them. Presently one of them caught sight of him, and with a shout he sprang across the grass and came into the street, followed by several others. There he stood in front of Pippin, looking him up and down. "Greetings," said the lad. "Where do you come from?"
"You're a stranger in the city."
"I was," said Pippin, "but they say I have become a man of Gondor."
"Oh, come," said the lad.
"Then we're all men here. But how old are you, and what's your name?"
"I'm 10 years already, and shall soon be 5 feet. I am taller than you, but then my father is a guard, one of the tallest."
"What is your father?"
"Which question shall I answer first?" said Pippin. "My father farms the lands around Whitwell, near Tuckborough, in the Shire. I'm nearly 29, so I pass you there, though I'm but 4 feet, and not likely to grow any more, save sideways."
29, said the lad, and whistled. "Why, you are quite old, as old as my uncle Iorlas. Still," he added hopefully, "I wager I could stand you on your head or lay you on your back."
"Maybe you could if I let you," said Pippin with a laugh, "and maybe I could do the same to you. We know some wrestling tricks in my little country. Where, let me tell you, I'm considered uncommonly large and strong, and I've never allowed anyone to stand me on my head. So if it came to a trial, and nothing else would serve, I might have to kill you. For when you're older, you will learn that folk are not always what they seem, and though you may have taken me for a soft stranger lad and easy prey, let me warn you, I am not. I am a halfling, hard, bold, and wicked." Pippin pulled such a grim face that the boy stepped back a pace, but at once he returned with clenched fists and the light of battle in his eyes.
"No," Pippin laughed, "don't believe what strangers say of themselves either. I'm not a fighter. But it would be politer in any case for the challenger to say who he is."
The boy drew himself up proudly.
"I am Bergil, son of Beregond of the Guards," he said. "So I thought," said Pippin. "For you look like your father. I know him, and he sent me to find you."
"Then why did you not say so at once?" said Bergil, and suddenly a look of dismay came over his face.
"Don't tell me that he has changed his mind, and will send me away with the maidens. But no, the last wains have gone."
"His message is less bad than that, if not good," said Pippin.
"He says that if you would prefer it to standing me on my head, you might show me round the city for a while and cheer my loneliness. I can tell you some tales of far countries in return."
Bergil clapped his hands and laughed with relief.
"All is well," he cried. "Come then. We were soon going to the gate to look on. We'll go now."
"What's happening there?"
"The captains of the outlands are expected up the south road ere sundown. Come with us and you'll see."
Bergil proved a good comrade, the best company Pippin had had since he parted from Merry, and soon they were laughing and talking gaily as they went about the streets, heedless of the many glances that men gave them. Before long they found themselves in a throng going towards the great gate. There Pippin went up much in the esteem of Bergil, for when he spoke his name and the password, the guard saluted him and let him pass through, and what was more, he allowed him to take his companion with him.
"That is good," said Bergil. "We boys are no longer allowed to pass the gate without an elder. Now we shall see better."
Beyond the gate there was a crowd of men along the verge of the road, and of the great paved space into which all the ways to Minas Tirith ran. All eyes were turned southwards, and soon a murmur rose.
"There is dust away there! They are coming!"
Pippin and Bergil edged their way forward to the front of the crowd and waited. Horns sounded at some distance, and the noise of cheering rolled towards them like a gathering wind. Then there was a loud trumpet blast, and all about them people were shouting.
"Forlong! Forlong!" Pippin heard men calling.
"What do they say?" he asked.
"Forlong has come," Bergil answered. "Old Forlong the Fat, the Lord of Lossarnach. That is where my grandsire lives. Hurrah! Here he is, good old Forlong!"
Leading the line there came walking a big, thick-limbed horse, and on it sat a man of wide shoulders and huge girth, but old and grey-bearded, yet mail-clad and black-helmed, and bearing a long, heavy spear. Behind him marched proudly a dusty line of men, well-armed and bearing great battle-axes. Grim-faced they were,
and shorter and somewhat swarthier than any men that Pippin had yet seen in Gondor.
"Forlong!" men shouted. "True heart! True friend! Forlong!"
But when the men of Los Arnoch had passed, they muttered, "So few! 200s! What are they? We hoped for 10 times the number. That will be the new tidings of the Black Fleet. They're sparing only a tithe of their strength. Still, every little is a gain." And so the companies came and were hailed and cheered and passed through the gate. Men of the outlands marching to defend the city of Gondor in a dark hour, but always too few, always less than hope looked for or need asked. The men of Ringlow Vale behind the son of their lord, Devoren striding on foot, 300s. From the uplands of Morthond, the great Blackroot Vale, tall Duin here and his sons, Duilin and Erufin, and 500 bowmen. From the Anfarlas, the Langstrand far away, a long line of men of many sorts, hunters and herdsmen and men of little villages, scantily equipped, save for the household of Golasgil their lord. From Lamedon, a few grim hillmen without a captain. Fisherfolk of the Aethir, some 100 or more spared from the ships. Hirluin the fair of the green hills from Pinath Gelin, with 300s of gallant green-clad men. And last and proudest, Imrahil, prince of Dol Amroth, kinsman of the lord, with gilded banners bearing his token of the ship and the silver swan, and a company of knights in full harness riding grey horses, and behind them 700s of men-at-arms, tall as lords, grey-eyed, dark-haired, singing as they came. And that was all, less than 3,000 full told. No more would come. Their cries and the tramp of their feet passed into the city and died away. The onlookers stood silent for a while. Dust hung in the air, for the wind had died, and the evening was heavy. Already the closing hour was drawing nigh, and the red sun had gone behind Mindoloin. Shadow came down on the city. Pippin looked up, and it seemed to him that the sky had grown ashen grey, as if a vast dust and smoke hung above them, and light came dully through it. But in the west the dying sun had set all the fume on fire, and now Mindoloin stood black against a burning smoulder flecked with embers. "So ends a fair day in wrath," he said, forgetful of the lad at his side. "So it will, if I have not returned before the sundown bells," said Virgil. "Come, there goes the trumpet for the closing of the gate." Hand in hand they went back into the city, the last to pass the gate before it was shut. And as they reached the lamplight street, all the bells in the towers tolled solemnly. Lights sprang in many windows, and from the houses and wards of the men-at-arms along the walls there came the sound of song. "Farewell for this time," said Virgil. "Take my greetings to my father, and thank him for the company that he sent. Come again soon, I beg." "Almost I wish now that there was no war, for we might have had some merry times. We might have journeyed to Los Arnoch, to my grandsire's house. It's good to be there in spring. The woods and fields are full of flowers. But maybe we'll go thither together yet. They will never overcome our lord, and my father is very valiant. Farewell and return." They parted, and Pippin hurried back towards the citadel. It seemed a long way, and he grew hot and very hungry, and night closed down swift and dark. Not a star pricked the sky. He was late for the day meal in the mess, and Beregond greeted him gladly, and sat him at his side to hear news of his son. After the meal Pippin stayed a while, and then took his leave, for a strange gloom was on him, and now he desired very much to see Gandalf again.
"Can you find your way?" said Beregond at the door of the small hall, on the north side of the citadel, where they had sat. "It's a black night, and all the blacker since orders came that lights are to be dimmed within the city, and none are to shine out from the walls. And I can give you news of another order. You will be summoned to the Lord Denethor early tomorrow.
I fear you'll not be for the third company. Still, we may hope to meet again. Farewell and sleep in peace. The lodging was dark, save for a little lantern set on the table. Gandalf was not there. Gloom settled still more heavily on Pippin. He climbed on the bench and tried to peer out of a window, but it was like looking into a pool of ink. He got down and closed the shutter and went to bed. For a while he lay and listened for sounds of Gandalf's return, and then he fell into an uneasy sleep. In the night he was wakened by a light, and he saw that Gandalf had come and was pacing to and fro in the room beyond the curtain of the alcove. There were candles on the table and rolls of parchment. He heard the wizard sigh and mutter, "When will Faramir return?" "Hallo," said Pippin, poking his head round the curtain. "I thought you'd forgotten all about me. I'm glad to see you back. It's been a long day."
"But the night will be too short," said Gandalf. "I've come back here, for I must have a little peace, alone. You should sleep in a bed while you still may. At the sunrise I shall take you to the Lord Denethor again. No, when the summons comes, not at sunrise. The darkness has begun. There will be no dawn."
Chapter 2 The Passing of the Grey Company. Gandalf was gone, and the thudding hooves of Shadowfax were lost in the night when Merry came back to Aragorn. He had only a light bundle, for he'd lost his pack at Parth Garlan, and all he had was a few useful things he'd picked up among the wreckage of Isengard. Hazufel was already saddled. Legolas and Gimli, with their horse, stood close by.
"So four of the company still remain," said Aragorn. "We'll ride on together. But we shall not go alone, as I thought. The king is now determined to set out at once. Since the coming of the Winged Shadow, he desires to return to the hills under cover of night."
"And then whither?" said Legolas.
"I can't say yet," Aragorn answered. "As for the king, he'll go to the muster that he commanded at Edoras 4 nights from now, and there, I think, he'll hear tidings of war, and the riders of Rohan will go down to Minas Tirith. But for myself, and any that will go with me—"
"I for one," cried Legolas.
"And Gimli with him," said the dwarf. "Well, for myself," said Aragorn, "it is dark before me. I must go down also to Minas Tirith, but I don't yet see the road. An hour, long prepared, approaches."
"Don't leave me behind," said Merry. "I've not been of much use yet, but I don't want to be laid aside, like baggage to be called for when all is over. I don't think the riders will want to be bothered with me now, though, of course, the king did say that I was to sit by him when he came to his house and tell him all about the Shire."
"Yes," said Aragorn, "and your road lies with him, I think, Merry. But don't look for mirth at the ending. It will be long, I fear, ere Théoden sits at ease again in Medwaseld. Many hopes will wither in this bitter spring." Soon all were ready to depart. 24 horses, with Gimli behind Legolas and Merry in front of Aragorn. Presently they were riding swiftly through the night. They had not long passed the mounds at the fords of Isen, when a rider galloped up from the rear of their line.
"My lord," he said to the king, "there are horsemen behind us. As we crossed the fords I thought that I heard them.
Now we are sure they are overtaking us, riding hard." Théoden at once called a halt. The riders turned about and seized their spears. Aragorn dismounted and set Merry on the ground, and drawing his sword he stood by the king's stirrup. Éomer and his esquire rode back to the rear. Merry felt more like unneeded baggage than ever, and he wondered, if there was a fight, what he should do. Supposing the king's small escort was trapped and overcome, but he escaped into the darkness,
alone in the wild fields of Rohan, with no idea of where he was in all the endless miles? No good, he thought. He drew his sword and tightened his belt. The sinking moon was obscured by a great sailing cloud, but suddenly it rode out clear again. Then they all heard the sound of hooves, and at the same moment they saw dark shapes coming swiftly on the path from the fords. The moonlight glinted here and there on the points of spears. The number of the pursuers could not be told, but they seemed no fewer than the king's escort, at the least. When they were some 50 paces off, Aomer cried in a loud voice, "Halt! Halt! Who rides in Rohan?" The pursuers brought their steeds to a sudden stand. A silence followed, and then in the moonlight a horseman could be seen dismounting and walking slowly forward. His hand showed white as he held it up, palm outward, in token of peace. But the king's men gripped their weapons. At 10 paces the man stopped. He was tall, a dark standing shadow. Then his clear voice rang out, "Rohan? Rohan, did you say? That is a glad word. We seek that land in haste from long afar." "You have found it," said Aomer. "When you crossed the fords yonder you entered it. But it is the realm of Theoden the king. None ride here save by his leave. Who are you, and what is your haste?"
"Halbarad Dunadan, ranger of the north I am," cried the man.
"We seek one Aragorn, son of Arathorn, and we heard that he was in Rohan."
"And you have found him also," cried Aragorn. Giving his reins to Merry, he ran forward and embraced the newcomer.
"Halbarad," he said, "of all joys this is the least expected."
Merry breathed a sigh of relief. He thought that this was some last trick of Saruman's, to waylay the king while he had only a few men about him. But it seemed that there would be no need to die in Theoden's defence, not yet at any rate. He sheathed his sword.
"All is well," said Aragorn, turning back. "Here are some of my own kin from the far land where I dwelt. But why they come, and how many they be, Halbarad shall tell us."
"I have 30 with me," said Halbarad. "That is all of our kindred that could be gathered in haste. But the brethren Eladan and Elro here have ridden with us, desiring to go to the war. We rode as swiftly as we might when your summons came."
"But I didn't summon you," said Aragorn, "save only in wish. My thoughts have often turned to you, and seldom more than to-night. Yet I've sent no word. But come, all such matters must wait. You find us riding in haste and danger. Ride with us now, if the king will give his leave."
Theoden was indeed glad of the news.
"It is well," he said. "If these kinsmen be in any way like to yourself, my lord Aragorn, 30 such knights will be a strength that cannot be counted by heads."
Then the riders set out again, and Aragorn for a while rode with the Dúnedain. And when they had spoken of tidings in the north and in the south, Elro here said to him,
"I bring word to you from my father. The days are short. If thou art in haste, remember the paths of the dead."
"Always my days have seemed to me too short to achieve my desire," answered Aragorn. "But great indeed will be my haste ere I take that road."
"That will soon be seen," said Elro here. "But let us speak no more of these things upon the open road."
And Aragorn said to Halbarad,
"What is that that you bear, kinsman?" For he saw that instead of a spear he bore a tall staff, as it were a standard, but it was close furled in a black cloth bound about with many thongs.
"It is a gift that I bring you from the Lady of Rivendell," answered Halbarad. "She wrought it in secret, and long was the making, but she also sends words to you. The days now are short. Either our hope cometh, or all hopes end. Therefore I send thee what I have made for thee. Farewell, Elfstone."
And Aragorn said, "Now I know what you bear. Bear it still for me a while.
And he turned and looked away to the north under the great stars, and then he fell silent and spoke no more while the night's journey lasted. The night was old and the east grey when they rode up at last from Deeping Combe and came back to the Hornburg. There they were to lie and rest for a brief while and take counsel. Merry slept until he was roused by Legolas and Gimli.
"The sun is high," said Legolas. "All others are up and doing. Come, Master Sluggard, and look at this place while you may."
"There was a battle here 3 nights ago," said Gimli, "and here Legolas and I played a game that I won only by a single orc. Come and see how it was. And there are caves, Merry, caves of wonder. Shall we visit them, Legolas, do you think?"
"Nay, there is no time," said the elf. "Do not spoil the wonder with haste. I have given you my word to return hither with you if a day of peace and freedom comes again. But it is now near to noon, and at that hour we eat, and then we set out again, I hear."
Merry got up and yawned. His few hours' sleep had not been nearly enough. He was tired and rather dismal. He missed Pippin, and felt that he was only a burden, while everybody was making plans for speed and a business that he didn't fully understand.
"Where's Aragorn?" he asked.
"In a high chamber of the burg," said Legolas. "He has neither rested nor slept, I think. He went thither some hours ago, saying that he must take thought, and only his kinsman, Halbred, went with him. But some dark doubt or care sits on him."
"They're a strange company, these newcomers," said Gimli. "Stout men and lordly they are, and the riders of Rohan look almost as boys beside them, for they are grim men of face, worn like weathered rocks for the most part, even as Aragorn himself, and they are silent."
"But even as Aragorn they are courteous if they break their silence," said Legolas. "And have you marked the brethren Eladan and Elro here? Less sombre is their gear than the others, and they are fair and gallant as elven lords, and that is not to be wondered at in the sons of Elrond of Rivendell."
"Why have they come? Have you heard?" asked Merry.
He had now dressed, and he flung his grey cloak about his shoulders, and the three passed out together towards the ruined gate of the burg.
"They answered a summons, as you heard," said Gimli. "Word came to Rivendell, they say. Aragorn has need of his kindred. Let the Dúnedain ride to him in Rohan. But whence this message came, they are now in doubt. Gandalf sent it, I would guess."
"Nay, Galadriel," said Legolas. "Did she not speak through Gandalf of the ride of the great company from the north?"
"Yes, you have it," said Gimli. "The Lady of the Wood, she read many hearts and desires. Now why did not we wish for some of our own kinsfolk, Legolas?"
Legolas stood before the gate and turned his bright eyes away north and east, and his fair face was troubled.
"I do not think that any would come," he answered. "They have no need to ride to war. War already marches on their own lands."
For a while the three companions walked together, speaking of this and of that turn of the battle, and they went down from the broken gate and past the mounds of the fallen on the greensward beside the road until they stood on Helm's Dyke and looked into the combe. The Death Down already stood there, black and tall and stony, and the great trampling and scoring of the grass by the Huons could be plainly seen. The Dunlendings and many men of the garrison of the burg were at work on the dyke, or in the fields and about the battered walls behind, yet all seemed strangely quiet, a weary valley resting after a great storm. Soon they turned back and went to the midday meal in the hall of the burg. The king was already there, and as soon as they entered he called for Merry and had a seat set for him at his side.
"It is not as I would have it," said Théoden, "for this is little like my fair house in Edoras, and your friend is gone, who should also be here. But it may be long ere we sit, you and I, at the high table in Meadowseld. There will be no time for feasting when I return thither." But come now, eat and drink, and let us speak together while we may, and then you shall ride with me.
May I? Said Merry, surprised and delighted. That would be splendid.
He had never felt more grateful for any kindness in words. I'm afraid I'm only in everybody's way, he stammered. But I should like to do anything I could, you know.
I doubt it not, said the king. I've had a good hill pony made ready for you. He will bear you as swift as any horse by the roads that we shall take. For I will ride from the burg by mountain paths, not by the plain, and so come to Edoras by way of Dunharrow, where the Lady Eowyn awaits me. You shall be my esquire, if you will. Is there gear of war in this place, Eomer, that my sword thane could use?
There are no great weapon hoards here, lord, answered Eomer. Maybe a light helm might be found to fit him, but we have no mail or sword for one of his stature.
I have a sword, said Merry, climbing from his seat, and drawing from its black sheath his small bright blade.
Filled suddenly with love for this old man, he knelt on one knee, and took his hand and kissed it.
May I lay the sword of Merry Adoc of the Shire on your lap, Theoden King? He cried. Receive my service if you will. Gladly will I take it, said the king, and laying his long old hands upon the brown hair of the hobbit, he blessed him. Rise now, Merry Adoc, esquire of Rohan, of the household of Meduseld, he said. Take your sword and bear it unto good fortune.
As a father you shall be to me, said Merry.
For a little while, said Theoden.
They talked then together as they ate, until presently Eomer spoke.
It is near the hour that we set for our going, lord, he said. Shall I bid men sound the horns? But where's Aragorn? His place is empty, and he hasn't eaten.
We will make ready to ride, said Theoden. But let word be sent to the Lord Aragorn that the hour is nigh.
The king with his guard and Merry at his side passed down from the gate of the burg to where the riders were assembling on the green. Many were already mounted. It would be a great company, for the king was leaving only a small garrison in the burg, and all who could be spared were riding to the weapon-take at Edoras. 1,000 spears had indeed already ridden away at night, but still there would be some 500 more to go with the king, for the most part men from the fields and dales of Westfold. A little apart the rangers sat, silent, in an ordered company, armed with spear and bow and sword. They were clad in cloaks of dark grey, and their hoods were cast now over helm and head. Their horses were strong and of proud bearing, but rough-haired, and one stood there without a rider, Aragorn's own horse that they had brought from the north. Roheron was his name. There was no gleam of stone or gold, nor any fair thing in all their gear and harness, nor did their riders bear any badge or token, save only that each cloak was pinned upon the left shoulder by a brooch of silver shaped like a rayed star. The king mounted his horse, Snowmane, and Merry sat beside him on his pony. Stibber was his name. Presently Eomer came out from the gate, and with him was Aragorn, and Halberad bearing the great staff close-furled in black, and two tall men, neither young nor old. So much alike were they, the sons of Elrond, that few could tell them apart. Dark-haired, grey-eyed, and their faces elven fair, clad alike in bright mail beneath the cloaks of silver grey. Behind them walked Legolas and Gimli. But Merry had eyes only for Aragorn, so startling was the change that he saw in him, as if in one night many years had fallen on his head. Grim was his face, grey-hued and weary. "I'm troubled in mind, lord," he said, standing by the king's horse. "I've heard strange words, and I see new perils far off. I've laboured long in thought, and now I fear that I must change my purpose. Tell me, Theoden, you ride now to Dunharrow. How long will it be ere you come there?" "It is now a full hour past noon," said Eomer. Before the night of the third day from now we should come to the hold. The moon will then be one night past his full, and the muster that the king commanded will be held the day after. More speed we cannot make, if the strength of Rohan is to be gathered." Aragorn was silent for a moment.
"3 days," he murmured, "and the muster of Rohan will only be begun. But I see that it cannot now be hastened."
He looked up, and it seemed that he had made some decision. His face was less troubled.
"Then, by your leave, Lord, I must take new counsel for myself and my kindred. We must ride our own road, and no longer in secret. For me the time of stealth is past. I will ride east by the swiftest way, and I will take the paths of the dead."
"The paths of the dead?" said Théoden, and trembled. "Why do you speak of them?"
Éomer turned and gazed at Aragorn, and it seemed to Merry that the faces of the riders that sat within hearing turned pale at the words.
"If there be in truth such paths," said Théoden, "their gate is in Dunharrow, but no living man may pass it."
"Alas, Aragorn, my friend," said Éomer, "I had hoped that we should ride to war together, but if you seek the paths of the dead, then our parting is come, and it is little likely that we shall ever meet again under the sun."
"That road I will take nonetheless," said Aragorn. "But I say to you, Éomer, that in battle we may yet meet again, though all the hosts of Mordor should stand between."
"You will do as you will, my lord Aragorn," said Théoden. "It is your doom, maybe, to tread strange paths that others dare not. This parting grieves me, and my strength is lessened by it. But now I must take the mountain roads and delay no longer. Farewell."
"Farewell, lord," said Aragorn. "Ride unto great renown. Farewell, Merry. I leave you in good hands, better than we hoped when we hunted the orcs to Fangorn. Legolas and Gimli will still hunt with me, I hope, but we shall not forget you."
"Goodbye," said Merry. He could find no more to say. He felt very small, and he was puzzled and depressed by all these gloomy words. More than ever, he missed the unquenchable cheerfulness of Pippin. The riders were ready, and their horses were fidgeting. He wished they would start and get it over. Now Théoden spoke to Éomer, and he lifted up his hand and cried aloud, and with that word the riders set forth. They rode over the dyke and down the coombe, and then, turning swiftly eastwards, they took a path that skirted the foothills for a mile or so, until, bending south, it passed back among the hills and disappeared from view. Aragorn rode to the dyke and watched till the king's men were far down the coombe. Then he turned to Halbered.
"There go three that I love, and the smallest not the least," he said. "He knows not to what end he rides, yet if he knew, he still would go on."
"A little people, but of great worth are the Shire folk," said Halbered. "Little do they know of our long labour for the safekeeping of their borders, and yet I grudge it not."
"And now our fates are woven together," said Aragorn. "And yet, alas, here we must part. Well, I must eat a little, and then we also must hasten away. Come, Legolas and Gimli, I must speak with you as I eat."
Together they went back into the burg. Yet for some time Aragorn sat silent at the table in the hall, and the others waited for him to speak.
"Come," said Legolas at last, "speak and be comforted, and shake off the shadow. What has happened since we came back to this grim place in the grey morning?"
"A struggle somewhat grimmer for my part than the Battle of the Hornburg," answered Aragorn. "I have looked in the stone of Orthanc, my friends."
"You have looked in that accursed stone of wizardry?"
exclaimed Gimli, with fear and astonishment in his face.
"Did you say aught to him? Even Gandalf feared that encounter."
"You forgot to whom you speak,"
said Aragorn sternly, and his eyes glinted.
"Did I not openly proclaim my title before the doors of Edoras? What do you fear that I should say to him?"
"Nay, Gimli," he said in a softer voice, and the grimness left his face,
and he looked like one who has laboured in sleepless pain for many nights. "Nay, my friends, I am the lawful master of the stone, and I had both the right and the strength to use it, or so I judged. The right cannot be doubted. The strength was enough. Barely." He drew a deep breath. "It was a bitter struggle, and the weariness is slow to pass. I spoke no word to him, and in the end I wrenched the stone to my own will. That alone he will find hard to endure. And he beheld me. Yes, Master Gimli, he saw me, but in other guise than you see me here. If that will aid him, then I have done ill. But I don't think so. To know that I lived and walked the earth was a blow to his heart, I deem, for he knew it not till now. The eyes in Orthonk did not see through the armour of Theoden, but Sauron has not forgotten Isildur and the sword of Elendil. Now in the very hour of his great designs, the heir of Isildur and the sword are revealed, for I showed the blade, reforged, to him. He is not so mighty yet that he is above fear. Nay, doubt ever gnaws him."
"But he wields great dominion nonetheless," said Gimli, "and now he will strike more swiftly."
"The hasty stroke goes oft astray," said Aragorn. "We must press our enemy, and no longer wait upon him for the move. See, my friends, when I had mastered the stone, I learned many things. A grave peril I saw coming unlooked for upon Gondor from the south that will draw off great strength from the defence of Minas Tirith. If it is not counted swiftly, I deem that the city will be lost ere 10 days be gone."
"Then lost it must be," said Gimli. "For what help is there to send thither, and how could it come there in time?"
"I have no help to send, therefore I must go myself," said Aragorn. "But there is only one way through the mountains that will bring me to the coastlands before all is lost. That is the paths of the dead."
"The paths of the dead," said Gimli. "It is a fell name, and little to the liking to the men of Rohan, as I saw. Can the living use such a road and not perish? And even if you pass that way, what will so few avail to counter the strokes of Mordor?"
"The living have never used that road since the coming of the Rohirrim," said Aragorn, "for it is closed to them. But in this dark hour the heir of Isildur may use it, if he dare. Listen. This is the word that the sons of Elrond bring to me from their father in Rivendell, wisest in law. Bid Aragorn remember the words of the seer and the paths of the dead."
"But what may be the words of the seer?" said Legolas.
"Thus spoke Malbeth the seer in the days of Arvedwë, last king at Fornost," said Aragorn. "Over the land there lies a long shadow, westward-reaching wings of darkness. The tower trembles, to the tombs of kings doom approaches. The dead awaken, for the hour is come for the oath-breakers. At the stone of Erech they shall stand again, and hear there a horn in the hills ringing. Whose shall the horn be? Who shall call them from the grey twilight, the forgotten people, the heir of him to whom the oath they swore? From the north shall he come, need shall drive him, he shall pass the door to the paths of the dead."
"Dark ways, doubtless," said Gimli, "but no darker than these staves are to me."
"If you would understand them better, then I bid you come with me," said Aragorn, "for that way I now shall take. But I don't go gladly, only need drives me. Therefore, only of your free will would I have you come, for you'll find both toil and great fear, and maybe worse."
"I will go with you even on the paths of the dead, and to whatever end they may lead," said Gimli.
"I also will come," said Legolas, "for I don't fear the dead."
"I hope that the forgotten people will not have forgotten how to fight," said Gimli, "for otherwise I see not why we should trouble them."
"That we shall know if ever we come to Erech," said Aragorn. "But the oath that they broke was to fight against Sauron, and they must fight therefore, if they are to fulfill it.
For at Erech there stands yet a black stone that was brought, it was said, from Numenor by Isildur. And it was set upon a hill, and upon it the king of the mountain swore allegiance to him in the beginning of the realm of Gondor. But when Sauron returned and grew in might again, Isildur